Chief O'Reilly, will you introduce Dr. Hare, please?
I certainly will. Good afternoon, members of the Commission and Commissioner Bull. Today, the Commonwealth is fortunate to have one of the leading scientists involved in climate change and also the vulnerability to our fish stocks and quite remarkable work. I've had the pleasure of having 3.5 years of continuing education credits because Dr. Hare addresses the Mid-Atlantic Council on several occasions during that time period. Dr. Hare has been with the National Marine Fisheries Service for 24 years and recently has been the director of the Narragansett Rhode Island Laboratory, and on October 1st becomes the acting director of the Northeast Fisheries Science Center. And so with that, it's really a pleasure to have Dr. Hare today.
Thank you, Dr. Hare. I appreciate you coming this distance. I understand you've come all the way from New England to address us here today.
I lived in North Carolina for a number of years.
We forgive you. we forgive you for that. Thank you. Please.
As Rob said, I've been talking at the Mid-Atlantic Fisheries Management Council for a number of years, also talking at Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission on the issue of climate change and fisheries. And so Rob asked me to come down and give a presentation to you. It'll be similar to some of what Rob has seen in the past, but I've gone through and sort of looked at some of our sort of coastwide results and took out the Virginia-specific results. So it will be tailored to Virginia, so hopefully it'll be a little more of interest than New England fisheries per se. Marine resources are important to Virginia. Looking at some of the economic statistics collected by NOAA Fisheries, is about 22,000 jobs, $1.3 billion in total sales from marine fisheries, recreational and commercial. There's $56 million in farm gate aquaculture. That's from a VIMS aquaculture report. You know, marine fisheries are important in terms of food security, cultural heritage, recreation and tourism, and coastal communities. So there's a lot at stake, and this commission certainly understands what's at stake. So climate change and climate variability. And this is where the scientist in me comes out as I try to distinguish these two different factors. Climate change is a long-term change in some component of the Earth, atmosphere, ocean system. And climate variability is simply variability in that Earth, atmosphere, ocean system. And what we see, what we experience today is a combination of the two. It's both climate change and variability. So if you say, well, today's kind of cool, for a late September day, that's the variability piece. The change piece is the fact that it is a little bit warmer than it was in the 1800s in October in this time period. So it's like what we experience today is a combination of the two. It's climate change and climate variability. And I like to use this figure to illustrate that difference. And this is the annual sea surface temperature for the Northeast U.S. shelf. So the average annual temperature from Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, up to the Hague line between the U.S. and Canada. And this record goes back to 1850 and extends through the present day. And this is based on an accumulation of all sorts of temperature observations. Yes, there's less data early in the time series. There's fewer people out with thermometers in the ocean in the 1800s than there are now. But it's been standardized to the best that scientists can to make this a consistent time series over that 150 years. And what you see in this time series is you see evidence of change, and that's that straight line that runs right through there. That's a climate change signal. That's a long-term change in the annual sea surface temperature of the Northeast U.S. continental shelf. And you also see variability, and that wiggly line that goes through there, that's one of the dominant climate variability signals in this region. It's the Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation. And it's a 50 to 70 year oscillation in sea surface temperatures across the whole North Atlantic. So if you think about this and just try to parse it out a little bit more, you can see that long-term change signal. It's that straight line. You see this multi-decadal oscillation signal. That's the wavy line. And then there's also a lot of interannual variability. So what we experience this year is a combination of that long-term change, that long-term multi-decadal variability, and the interannual variability. And so it's those combinations of change and variability that we need to think about when we're considering effects on marine fisheries. So some of the other climate change variables that we're looking at in this region, the Mid-Atlantic has, I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but it's one of the global hotspots for sea level rise. And this slide shows the rate of sea level rise in the color from 1970 to 2009. And you'll see the Mid-Atlantic all the way from the Bay of Fundy all the way down to probably Newport News and Virginia Beach are red symbols, and that means that sea level rise has been high in this region, 4 to 6 millimeters per year. I mean, that's not very much, but over 50, 60, 70, 80 years, even the 4 or 6 millimeter sea level rise amounts to that much or that much storm surge on top of that. It's that you can see the effects of it. When you go south of Cape Hatteras, sea level rise has been, as you can see, close to zero. So there's regional variability, and this region is a hotspot globally for sea level rise. It's also, you can see the climate change signal in precipitation. This is the change in precipitation from 1990 to 2000. So north of that black line, basically north of the Virginia border, it's more precipitation now than in the past. The percentages are positive. And south of that line, it's more, maybe a little less in sort of the southern North Carolina, South Carolina, a little more through Virginia. But you can see as you get north of Virginia that there's been a real change in the amount of precipitation between 1990 and 2012. And I could go through, and Rob has sat through hours of this sort of, this is what is changing. I could show you data on large-scale circulation. I could show you data on pH of the ocean, how much carbon dioxide is in the ocean. I could show you data on wind patterns, and I could show you data on salinity. I could show you a lot of data that supports the conclusion that the ocean systems, the climate is changing, and it is variable. And so we need to, as we move into sort of marine resource management, what does that mean if we have a changing climate and a variable climate over the order of decades and years? So again, it's change and variability. It's not one or the other. So looking forward, we've had the opportunity to work NOAA Fisheries, many of you know. We're responsible for fisheries management and protected species management. There's also a group of NOAA called NOAA Research. And NOAA Research is the home for two of the world-class climate modeling centers in the world. One of them is the Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory in Princeton, New Jersey, and the other one is the Earth Systems Research Laboratory in Boulder, Colorado. So we can use this part of NOAA and look at what these world-class climate models are projecting for the future of this area. And this is shows the output. It's the projection of sea surface temperature increase in the latter half of the coming century compared to the past 50 years. And first you'll notice how blocky it is. You see Long Island, Chesapeake Bay, you see these straight lines. That's because these models, even though they're sophisticated, take a lot of computer time to run, they're still low resolution, about 1 degree resolution, 60 miles. So each component of the model is about 60 miles wide. So you get this blockiness. Even with these models, we're suggesting a 1 to 1.5 degree increase in temperature in this region over the next 50 years. But these modeling centers are also developing high-resolution models. So this is a model which is 10 times greater the resolution of the model that I showed you previously. And this model has been developed at the Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory. And now you can see what looks like an ocean. And you can see a continental shelf, and you can see Chesapeake Bay. And that's because the models are higher resolution. And when you look at these higher resolution models in this region, you're now seeing not a 1 to 1.5 degree projected increase Celsius. You're now seeing a 2 to 3 degree projected change Celsius. And the reason for that is you have the water is warming. It's storing more heat. And the low resolution models captured that. But the Gulf Stream is also changing position. The Gulf Stream is part of the North Atlantic circulation. It's warm and salty. These models suggest it's going to push further north, which is going to push warmer water into our region. So our water is warming both because of changes in ocean circulation and because the water itself is warming up. So we're looking at between a 1 to 3 degree increase in temperature in our waters in the next 50 to 80 years. So where are we going? So this is a cartoon. You think of it as my son doing it. You might do it with crayons, but I did it on a computer. That projection out into the future, future uncertainty, that's not data. That's just a cartoon of sort of some of the dilemmas, some of the uncertainty that we're facing. climate change is going to continue. That's we're 50, at least 50 years out of equilibrium, so the climate change signal is going to continue no matter what we do. The climate variability signal is also going to continue. That's an inherent part of the system. And so what we don't know is how that multi-decadal oscillation, that wave, is going to interact with that straight line. So I can't, as a scientist, I don't think there are many scientists who can tell you what the next 10, 20, 30 years is going to bring. But it will, we'll see both climate change and climate variability. And the magnitude could be large, you know, anywhere from 1 to 3 degrees Celsius, which is like, what, 1.5 to 5 degrees Fahrenheit. So there's a lot of uncertainty, but yet we still need to manage living marine resources today. So let's look at some of the observed changes. What have we already seen in fish populations? And so this brings us, you know, what is changing? Distributions. We know that the distributions of many species are changing. The example here is red hake, but I could show you 20, 30 species that similarly show a shift to the north and into deeper waters. Why is it changing? It's changing because the temperature is changing, which I just showed you. The carbon dioxide in the water is changing, which I didn't show you, but I could have. Salinities on the shelf are changing because the Gulf Stream is pushing north. The water is getting a little saltier. So how is it going to change? Productivity of fish populations is going to change. The distribution of fish populations is going to change. The timing at which they enter and exit places like Chesapeake Bay is going to change. And so the question which we're faced, VMRC, NOAA Fisheries, Mid-Atlantic Fisheries Management Council, Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, how do we manage resources in a changing environment? If you think about much of the management that we do, it's based on the idea that the environment is variable but not changing. Multi-decadal climate variability and climate change means the environment is changing over the time periods that we're managing. So it creates issues for us in terms of our management. So NOAA Fisheries has released the climate science strategy. We released it in August 2015, and it's a national strategy. And it's, you know, it's relatively ambitious to develop both the science, the understanding, and support the advice that councils and others need to make regarding marine resources. It works across the whole enterprise in NOAA Fisheries. Again, many people think of NOAA Fisheries in terms of fisheries management, but we also have responsibilities under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, under the Endangered Species Act. We review more than 2,000 habitat actions each year in terms of permitting. There's more than 200 aquaculture actions that are reviewed at NOAA Fisheries. And there's a number of sort of NEPA, National Environmental Policy Act, issues that need to be resolved. Climate change can influence all of these potentially. So we're talking about fisheries, but it really affects us across our whole mission. This climate science strategy lays out 7 objectives. It's a nice pyramid. It looks nice on a slide, building one off the other. That's kind of the idea. You know, build and maintain adequate infrastructures at the bottom. And then at the peak, it's, you know, how do you develop climate-informed reference points to support decisions? So we're working across that whole gradient to try to bring climate advice and science into our enterprise. So the immediate actions identified in the climate science strategy were to conduct climate vulnerability analyses nationally, and we've already done that in the Northeast. It's to establish and strengthen ecosystem indicators and status reports. We have a ecosystem status report produced by the center every 2 years, and Rob has heard about that at the Mid-Atlantic Fisheries Management Council. I'm happy to share that with anyone who's interested. Develop the capacity to conduct management strategy evaluations. That's sort of a simulation technique where you look at different management approaches, see how a simulated environment responds, see if you're getting the response that you want, and then choosing a management strategy based on sort of a science-based, evidence-based, in a simulating environment. And then the next thing that these climate science strategy called for is the development of a regional action plan. That's basically, I'm not really much of a strategic planner, but we have a strategic plan, and this is calling for an implementation plan in each region. So what I'm going to talk about a little bit more today is the climate vulnerability assessment, which we've completed in the Northeast, and then I'll finish just on the regional action plan, sort of where we're planning to go. So the climate vulnerability assessment, the goal is to produce a practical and efficient tool for assessing the vulnerability of a wide range of fish stocks to a changing climate. And the objectives were to develop relative vulnerability rankings across species. So how vulnerable is species X to climate change? How vulnerable is species Y? How vulnerable is species Z? determine the attributes or factors that determine that vulnerability, both the biological attributes and the physical climate attributes, and then use this to help identify data quality issues and data gaps, where if you want to make a decision about species Z, but you don't have enough information, this might be the type of information that you want to collect to improve your decision. We sort of developed three different metrics of climate vulnerability. The first one is vulnerability, and that's the risk that a population or species will change in productivity. So productivity is basically, you know, how many kids is a group of fish going to have? If they're going to have a lot of kids and they're all going to survive, it has high productivity. If they're going to have a few kids and only a few are going to survive, they're going to have low productivity. Much of our assessment framework is based on the idea that productivity is constant through time. Climate change means that productivity may not be constant through time. So what's the vulnerability of species X for a change in productivity? We also looked at the potential to shift distributions. That has been a big issue at the Mid-Atlantic and Atlantic states in terms of how to manage species that are changing distribution. So we developed a metric to look at the potential for species X to change distribution. And then we also looked at, is the effect of climate change in this region, in the Northeast United States, likely to be positive, neutral, or negative? And this helps us kind of get at the situation of which species are going to do better under a changing climate in the Northeast, in the Mid-Atlantic, and which species are likely to do worse in the Northeast, in the Mid-Atlantic. And so this, it's a vulnerability assessment framework. It's very different from a standard stock assessment model. It sort of looks at things as expert opinion, and it looks at two components. One is the exposure to climate change. So how much is sea surface temperature going to change in this region over the next 50 years? How much is air temperature going to change in this region over the next 50 years? And it works through a bunch of exposure factors. It then looks at the species attributes. So how, what's the habitat specificity of species X? If this species depends on a specific habitat, it's more vulnerable to change than if it's a generalist. And it also looks at sensitivity to temperature. If it's highly sensitive to temperature, it's more vulnerable to change. If it can withstand any temperature, it's less vulnerable to change. So it's a structured approach to scoring these exposure factors and sensitivity factors to then compare across multiple species. So I'm going to show the results for this vulnerability assessment from a Virginia viewpoint. And I went into the NOAA Fisheries commercial fish statistics and took out the species which make up 99% of the commercial catch in terms of value. I went into the NOAA Fisheries recreational statistics and pulled out 99% commercial catch in numbers. And then I also went to the VIMS aquaculture report to pull out your two most aquaculture species, eastern oyster and hard clam, which we call quahog in New England. Some of the species that weren't included, so we had in the list, which would have been included if I took a Virginia-specific, we don't have gizzard shad, we don't have snails, we don't have catfish, we don't have swordfish, we don't have white perch, we don't have toadfish, we don't have skates and rays or sea robins or pigfish or puffers or black drums or mullets. When I put a list together like this, I realized we should have done better. We could have included more species, but we got, you know, a lot of them, so you'll see that in a minute. So this is what we call the vulnerability matrix, and on the bottom of the matrix, along, you know, the x-axis, as it were, is climate exposure. And it goes from low, moderate, high to very high. There's four categories down there. And then on the y-axis, or the vertical, is what's called biological sensitivity. And again, it goes from low, moderate, high, and very high. The first point is that in this region, climate exposure is high and very high for all the species. What that means is that the magnitude of climate change that we are expecting in the next 50 years is high or very high for all of our species. It's a system-wide, system-wide effect of climate. Climate change is going to be a main driver in this region. The biological sensitivity species spread out across this range from low all the way up to very high. So we see this segregation. Looking at specific species, northern quahog, is the red is it's very highly vulnerable to climate change. That comes from both ocean acidification and temperature sensitivities. You also see eastern oyster is very high. Again, that's ocean acidification and temperature. Now, acidification in coastal waters is much more complicated than it is in the open ocean. So, yes, we could look at acidification through a more nuanced lens. But that's harder to do. So right now, We're basically saying ocean acidification creates a vulnerability for northern quahog or hard clam and eastern oyster. Some of the ones down in the low sensitivity, the green, long inshore squid, spiny dogfish, bluefish, monkfish, their productivity is not likely to be impacted by climate change in this region. And then you sort of spread out between the low and the high. And I'll leave this presentation for you so people can go and look for their favorite species. In terms of vulnerability for changes in distribution, again, we rank species from very high to low. The compelling pattern that you see here is that for most of the species, commercial and recreational in Virginia, there's a high potential for a change in distribution. Changing distributions is probably one of the hardest management issues that's going to need to be addressed in this region as many species change distribution in response to climate change. It's already being addressed at the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, at the Mid-Atlantic Fisheries Management Council. Those problems are going to continue and probably get greater into the future. In terms of positives and negatives, so which species are likely to be negatively impacted by climate change, which species are likely to be positively impacted by climate change. For Virginia, I think the optimistic view is that you have a number of species which are likely to be positively affected by climate change in this region. When I give this talk in Maine, it's not everything's on the red side. So, you've got some opportunities, you have some potential positives that can come out of this. And the challenge for management is going to be managing the species which are going to be negatively impacted, managing the challenges that you have, but then also taking advantage of the opportunities that you might have coming from climate change. The other, I have the reference for the vulnerability assessment down at the bottom of the slide. For each species, there's a specific discussion about species narrative. So what do we know about climate change effects specifically? It's 2 to 3 page narrative. So if you're interested in this case, it's alewife. There's 2 to 3 pages that talk about the results specifically from an alewife perspective. What is known? What are some of the sensitivities? How does the life history interact with those climate exposures? So if you're interested in a particular species, I encourage you to read the species narrative. So that was the climate vulnerability assessment. And another thing which we have done in NOAA Fisheries is linked the fisheries climate vulnerability assessment to a community vulnerability assessment. NOAA Fisheries has a group of economists and social scientists, and they work on sort of the economic consequences of a council action or what are the social impacts of Hurricane Sandy on the fishing community in the New York, New Jersey area. And we worked with several of the social scientists to couple the fisheries community fisheries climate vulnerability assessment to their community indicators tool set. It's a national collection of social indicators for fishing communities. And so by taking our regional climate vulnerability assessment and linking it with this social indicators, we're able to look at what is the community level vulnerability for communities across the coast, but in Virginia for today's talk, for the climate effects on fisheries into those communities. And it's into those communities based on the value of landings at your particular communities through Virginia. So when you put the map together, this is and again, we're looking at 6 communities in Virginia, Reedville, Seaford, Hampton, and Newport News, Accomack, and Chincoteague. And so there's 6 pie diagrams here. The colors, the red, are the percentage of catch by value for species that are highly vulnerable to climate change from our vulnerability assessment. The blue are species which are moderately vulnerable, and the yellow are species which have a low vulnerability. So that's the color. And then the wedges are the percent of landings at that port of that species. So Reedville, in the commercial fishery statistics, 100% of the landings are Atlantic menhaden, whereas at Chincoteague, the commercial landings are much more diversified. So you can look at the vulnerability of a community from the basis of the vulnerability of the species that are landed there, but you can also look at it from like a portfolio vulnerability. So Reedville, menhaden is moderately vulnerable to climate change, and the community has no diversity in its fisheries landing. So that would make it a community which is more vulnerable to change than, say, for example, Chincoteague. Chincoteague has sort of a variety, has a portfolio, a diversified fisheries landings, which is going to make it more resilient to change. And this is, you know, a way for communities and states to think about the pattern of landings through their state or through their regions and think about, you know, what types of changes may you want to make or how may you want to manage Atlantic menhaden or changes in sea scallops, which is almost, you know, 99% of the landings in Seaford. Those communities with very low diversity in species are more susceptible to change. And so it's more just information provided to you to help you make the decisions that you make. So then coming back to the climate science strategy, the last piece, and we're getting near the end of my talk, is to develop this regional action plan, an implementation plan for the national strategy. We're almost done. October 3rd is when it gets submitted to NOAA Fisheries Headquarters. Rob has seen this at the Mid-Atlantic and at Atlantic State in a public comment period, and we've incorporated those comments, and now we're getting close to finalizing the plan. I just pulled out, there's 15 sort of actions which we identified, and I pulled out six here just to emphasize. So we need to really work to incorporate climate change science into our stock assessments. That's a challenge, yes. But we recognize that challenge, and we have a list of activities to support making progress on that challenge. We need to maintain and or restore our ecosystem and climate surveys in the Northeast. You know, data collection is fundamental to anything else that you want to do. You have to have data to understand how the system is behaving. So in the Northeast, over the past several years, we've had, you know, some surveys which have been reduced in funding. We're trying to get the funding restored to there so we can get to some baseline ecosystem and climate surveys to provide the data that we know we're going to need going forward. We understand and we want to work with industry to collect, understand, and incorporate fisheries and climate data into assessment and management. You know, fisheries management, as we see here, you know, earlier in the oysters discussion, is a participatory process in the United States, and so we need to involve all the participants in the science that we do to sort of generate support for the decisions that are made. We need to improve climate and fisheries forecasting and predicting capability. I talked about our work with the NOAA research climate models, but there's a lot more on the scientific end that we need to do to stitch those, the biological models and the climate models together. We need to conduct lab and field experiments to understand the mechanistic effects of climate change on fisheries. We're sort of right now working in sort of a correlation scale, so a species which is very specific to a certain habitat is highly vulnerable, and a species which is general is not. That's a pretty coarse statement, and we really need sort of the experimental work and the process-based work to understand the mechanisms between that in greater detail. And then we need to coordinate and cooperate across the region, including New England Fisheries Management Council, Mid-Atlantic Fisheries Management Council, Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, states, VMRC, the tribes, and other NOAA programs, universities, and NGOs. So really challenging us to cooperate and partner more than we have been. So just some last thoughts. You know, the climate change issue as an issue is contentious, but from my perspective as a scientist, the data supporting the statement that climate change is occurring is strong. There's also data that supports climate variability is occurring. Those two things are not separate. We're both experiencing climate change and climate variability. And so one side of that question is, how should we act? How should we, what should we do or what should we not do regarding the climate change issue? And that's a debate and a discussion that, you know, as a scientist involved in living marine resource management, is not for me to wage into. I'm on the other side of this fence. We know the ecosystem is going to respond to climate change and climate variability. We know the system is at least 50 years out of equilibrium, so whatever changes we make today, we're not going to see it for 50 years. So we need to start dealing with the climate change and climate variability issues in our management today. And that means, how will the marine species be effective, and how are we going to meet our management objectives in a changing environment? So take-home messages. Impacts of climate change in the Northeast U.S. and Virginia are likely to be large, owing to the magnitude of past changes that have been documented and future changes that are projected. Climate change creates significant challenges for living marine resource management, but there are some opportunities. And so it's not a glass is half empty completely. There are some opportunities that can be taken if we can be adaptive and responsive. And NOAA Fisheries, who I work for, is preparing to take these challenges on and try to make the opportunities that we can. We're doing a lot of science. We released our climate science strategy in 2015 to lay sort of a national framework guidance for us to follow. We've got a regional implementation plan, which will be sort of implemented beginning the next fiscal year, which is for us next week. And we're committed to working with partners and stakeholders. So that's all I have to say today, and I'm happy to answer questions if there are.
Yes, there surely will be questions. Before we move into that, could you back up to the slide where you had basically our winners and losers? There we go. I suspect that's going to be a lot of the questioning here. Mr. Zedrin.
We had the opportunity, I guess, here during the COBIA regulations to talk about what Virginia was going to do. And it seemed that the watermen had some issue with the reliability of the data for these findings that the scientists come up with, and especially the recreational catch statistics. Can you talk a minute about the reliability of the data that you're receiving to make all these predictions?
So it varies across source, and recreational data by its nature is more challenging than commercial fishing data. Commercial fishing data, most permits have a reporting requirement, whereas recreational, it's sort of state to state and species by species. So the recreational data is more challenging. We did not include COBIA. COBIA is not even managed by Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, is it? It's South Atlantic Fisheries Management Council. So that's, it's, something like COBIA, even if our recreational reporting was great, we may still have problems with something like COBIA because it's a, it's not a new species in this region, but it's not managed by the Northeast region. The issue, and I'm not trying to detract from your question, but I am going to take a tangent. Blue line tilefish is similar. It started being landed up here in the late 2000s, became an emergency measure for the Mid-Atlantic Fisheries Management Council to deal with. Basically it had been landed here, but never really thought that it was being landed in enough numbers to have a management plan. So Mid-Atlantic Fisheries Management Council put in an emergency action, and now they're rolling blue line tilefish management up into the tilefish management plan. So, recreational data is harder than commercial data. So recreational species, these projections will be have more uncertainty in them. And then a species like COBIA illustrates that even if we have good data on what we are collecting now, we also have to be ready to collect data on these species that are going to be new to our region, like blue line, like COBIA. I had a slide. I didn't have it in this presentation, but we're catching COBIA up in Narragansett Bay. So it's gone from a South Atlantic Fisheries Management Council species to a Virginia species, Rhode Island and Massachusetts now. So COBIA, something like COBIA presents a lot of problems because it's a recreational species, highly migratory, and the data is very limited.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
I was kind of interested in your comment about pH, and it's a lot more predictable and easy to, I guess, track in the open ocean. And as you get to coastal environments, it's more complicated. Can you speak to maybe what NOAA is doing to predict pH a little bit more in coastal environments?
So I think my answer would be in coastal environments, there's observing networks that are being deployed. And so I know that there's an observing effort in Delaware Bay. I don't know about Chesapeake Bay. So I can't, one point is first collect the baseline data of what is carbonate chemistry in these coastal areas. So then you have to start having data. And then you need to look at what factors are affecting carbonate chemistry in these coastal waters. In the open ocean, you increase carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, more of it dissolves into the ocean. Carbon dioxide, when it's dissolved, is acidic. You start decreasing the pH in the ocean. And it's pretty straightforward. It's an atmospheric input. In coastal waters, you have freshwater input, which is a varying pH. You also have primary productivity, which is basically using that carbon to make biological carbon. So it's the combination of freshwater input, primary productivity, and then atmospheric CO2, along with several others, which makes the dynamic more difficult. So the first thing, collecting the data. Second thing, doing the research to better understand the processes. And it's scattered, you know, so there's the effort in Delaware Bay. There's an effort up in the Gulf of Maine. I don't know about Chesapeake Bay, but, you know, we are working in that area, but it's harder because it's more complex.
Thank you. Can I ask a follow-up question?
Sure, Ms. Thurston.
In that slide in particular, the red seems to be, I can't read it all, I guess, but exclusively or mostly shellfish. So with the back to the pH thing, is that the driver and the reason that it's negative?
So it's pH and temperature. But you know, your shellfish are hitting there primarily because of the pH. And so something like, you know, northern quahog or hard clam, eastern oyster are estuarine. So you'd want to interpret these results in the context that coastal acidification is harder than ocean acidification. But Atlantic sea scallops, you know, that's an oceanic species. The carbonic chemistry on the shelf is a little more straightforward, and the patterns are a little more, the pH is going to go down in shelf waters. And so Atlantic sea scallop will likely be impacted. And we have a study which was completed a year ago looking, you know, basically you expect to start seeing the acidification effect in sea scallops in sort of like the 30 to 40, 50-year range.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome.
Other questions from the commission? I have one. Let me walk my way through the question here. So we'll see projected distribution changes in these stocks. Do you have a degree of expectations on just how bad it will be with these negative impacts? Because I'm guessing that there's a variety of different factors. Once the stocks start to move, we got, you know, predator-prey interactions. We got reproductive changes here as a result of that distribution. How comfortable are you? You know, what kind of range of problems we?
This is a first order. Here's an expert opinion, first order, trying to look across 82 species. So then, getting at your question, you know, specifically, how is reproduction going to be affected? How are predator-prey interactions going to be affected? How is habitat use going to be affected? That's not here. And our science isn't there yet. But by, you know, putting something like this and making it available, it sets a foundation from which we can build into those types of questions. So, you know, we've done projections. I haven't personally, but in this region there have been projections on, you know, 50-plus species going out into the future, treating each species individually. So the next step is, well, let's start layering on predator-prey interactions. Let's start layering in habitat interactions, or let's start layering in different rates of fishing. So again, you know, from my perspective, science is a stepwise process. You set a foundation, and then you take the next step. And so getting to your more complicated and nuanced issues is the next step, but we're not there yet.
Does it fill you with a sense of trepidation?
No, I mean, again, it's, you know, I see my job as a scientist to provide information and advice to help panels like you make better decisions. And so, you know, my perspective is if I can work on just continuing to provide the best science available, that will help you. It may not be answers that you want, but will provide, you know, decisions that are better supported in scientific evidence.
Mr. Zedrin.
Have you considered the fact that maybe some of these species, especially in the red, could adapt to the changes?
Yeah, I mean, that's an excellent question, and the answer is no. But that's clearly not right. If you believe in the theory of evolution, then we know that species can adapt. So much of all of what has been done to date assumes that species are basically a species 40 years ago is the same as it is today, is the same as going to be 40 years in the future. And getting into that sort of the adaptation and acclimation is another complexity. You do work like this, you identify that as a weakness, and then that generates sort of the next iteration of science to look at that question and resolve that weakness. So I was just up at VIMS this morning, and they have some, you know, experiments in developing capacity to look at the issue of acclimation and intergenerational sort of ability to respond to temperature changes and pH changes. So, no, we don't include that, but you know, it's a recognized issue, and there are people that are starting to, you know, working in that area.
Other questions from the commission?
One more.
Mr. Tanker.
Do you ever think about changes that are more than just a century or so? I mean, are we now in a warming trend that's coming to its finish, or are we now going to be soon entering a cooling phase? I hear people talk about a potential cooling phase.
So I think, just bear with me here. There you go.
Yeah.
You know, we're, you know, that red dot, this is 2012, which is, you know, the warmest year in the Northeast U.S. shelf in the 150-year record. We've come off of that a little bit. And so, you know, are we, this is the past, you know, 12 years. Are we going to come down? And, you know, on the backside of the Atlantic multi-decadal oscillation, or are we going to keep going up because of climate change? And I can't answer that question for you. In this region in particular, that decadal, the 10-year scale, is very hard. You know, I can, with reasonable confidence, tell you that 100 years from now, if we keep emitting CO2 as we are now, it'll be warmer. But that, you know, 10-year and sort of shorter fives, one, is much, much harder. So I can't tell you if next year is going to be warmer than this year. So I think the challenge is, don't create management structures that plan on a warming world. Think about management that's adaptable to changes in the environment. And if you're adaptable one way or the other, you'll be able to respond if the warming continues or if we come down the backside of the AMO and it gets a little cooler. Think about adaptable management, not fixing your management to current conditions or conditions in the future.
Question was more along the lines of a longer time period. Or is there yet another curve out there that's many hundreds of years?
Yeah, I mean, that you'd have to ask a paleoceanographer that question. I think 100 years for me is still a long ways away. We've been trying to push working with the climate community, the scientists at GFDL and at Earth Systems Research Laboratory, to really work on that, 2 to 20-year scale in this region. We do have some projects that are working at sort of like the 1-week scale. And then we have projects that are sort of like this 20 to 30-year scale. And so we're trying to push, you know, we're trying to bring the long-term, sort of the shorter-term, we're trying to take our short-term stuff to longer-term. But that's for, you know, management, natural resource management is sort of that, you know, 1-year to 20-year scale where I think we really need to focus our attention. So, yeah, you know, over 150 years, you ask a paleoceanographer.
Okay.
Mr. France.
Yeah, I guess CO2 would be the main driver now in climate change. Is that the thought?
One of the main drivers, yes. All again, right. I'm not a climate scientist. Okay. I'm a fisheries right. Oceanographer.
Okay. Well, my next question would be, what, in your opinion, is causing the Gulf Stream to move further northward?
So it's interesting. It has to do with the larger scale wind field over the Atlantic and changes that are occurring there because of the warming atmosphere. And so the Gulf Stream is pushing further north because of that large basin-wide change. And, you know, the Gulf Stream is connected. I don't know how detailed you want me to get as an oceanographer. I can really get into this stuff and start talking about it. The water comes out of the slope sea, out of the Labrador Sea. It's cold and fresh. And then it sinks. And then sort of comes under the Gulf Stream, and that's part of what drives this overriding circulation. As that water gets fresher and warmer, it's sinking less. And so it's slowing down that overturning. And part of the dynamics of that is that the Gulf Stream is pushing further northward. And it's, you know, it's all wrapped into the large scale, basin-wide circulation. And there's, you know, the time series for a Gulf Stream position are not, you know, they're like on the 20 to 30-year scale. So it's hard to say, is the Gulf Stream pushing northward? Is that long-term change, or is that multi-decadal variability? We just don't have the data to really make a, you know, differentiate between those two options. But in the past 10, 15 years, it has been pushing further north, and that's bringing warmer and saltier water to off of Virginia, but also entering into the Gulf of Maine. And so when you take the and project it forward, you know, the warming that we're going to see in this region is both the water warming, but then also these changes in the larger scale circulation.
I guess you said we looked at 80-something species?
82 species.
Where can we see that?
I can send you the link to the article. Or
yeah, I would appreciate that. And so you know, get that to us, John. Can we do that?
Yeah. Okay. Rob will make sure you get that.
That would be good information.
Yeah. And, you know, we had to draw the line somewhere. So looking at the list when I did the Virginia statistics, I might have added some more, but... We had, you know, we had to get started at some point. And
do that for your next paper.
Yeah, maybe not mine.
Okay.
Are there other questions from the commission? I'm going to throw this open to staff. Staff, you all deal with this on a daily basis here. Do you have any questions, Dr. Hare? I mean, he's come a long way here. He's got a heck of a brain. He knows stuff.
Not that far.
Well, from my standards, it's pretty far.
Yeah, close, but not quite there.
So I have just more, not really a question, but a comment. When I first heard Dr. Harris speak at the Mid-Atlantic Council, I went home and immediately grabbed my 1978 undergraduate textbook, Atmospheric Meteorology, and I looked in there and it said, "We are in a cooling period." And I related that story at the council, so it goes to show you how much has changed.
Yeah, so 1972 is right here. You know, we very much were in a cooling period. We're sliding down the backside of the Atlantic multi-decadal oscillation. So the interaction between that multi-decadal oscillation and climate change going forward is uncertainty. We don't, you know, I'm not sure that anyone can tell you what it's going to be, if it's going to get cooler or it's going to get warmer. But it is going to change. So.
I do have one question about that. So
please.
Right now, I mean, some of this response has been pretty abrupt. So, for example, New Hampshire asked to be part of the Black Sea Bass Climate Stop Management Plan because there was movement of the sea bass up north to that extent. And that's on a pretty quick scale. On the other end, we have summer flounder, which has had the last good year class 2009, striped bass.
So I hear two different types of questions there. So I'll answer the second one that I heard. And it's, you know, basically there's a lot of interannual variability in recruitment. And so how much of that is interannual, how much of that is multi-decadal, and how much of that is long-term change? I don't think we have the data series or long enough for recruitment time series to really think about the long-term change. Maybe the VIMS juvenile survey is probably one of the longest running juvenile surveys, the East Coast survey, so that would be a place to look. But so recruitment is variable, and it's complicated. And I think it's going to be hard to tease out sort of a long-term trend out of recruitment time. But it, you know, if recruitment stays low, you don't see those strong year classes. And I think you have to consider a change in your system. And the question which I heard first was black sea bass being up north. I think it's interesting. I gave a talk at VIMS this morning, a different talk, but it's fascinating. In the 1957, Taylor and Bigelow and Graham, some of these names, famous scientists from the Northeast region, they wrote about climate is changing. Everyone knows it's warming. Scientists don't agree, but I think they finally have to agree because the evidence is overwhelming. And we see all of these species moving north, and we even have black sea bass in the Gulf of Maine. They wrote this paper right here.
they're writing based on this perspective. And your book is based on that perspective. And the recent warming that you hear about is based on this perspective. So you start to realize that everything that you think you know is perspective-based in time, and things are changing through time. And so you need to start thinking about how am I going to change, you know, how am I also going to change my perspectives through time on these resources. So that sort of gets to the black sea bass question. They were in the Gulf of Maine in the early 50s, which was remarkable. We just kind of forgot about that. We got coal again. Yeah, right here. You're welcome. Sorry I couldn't answer your summer flounder recoupment question.
That's right.
Dr. Hare, we have another question from staff. Ryan.
So we've had just a lot of trouble incorporating these things into stock assessments. And it seems that some of it is lack of data, but I think some of the shortcomings are just we don't have that conceptual understanding yet. But I guess my question is, with all the different ways that climate change could affect not only an individual fish in terms of growth rate, reproductive output, but also the fishery, the population. Are there any little components of climate change effects that we are getting close to in terms of being able to incorporate it into an assessment? Because we've had a lot of trouble just getting ecosystem effects inside of a model in general. So, you know, I guess is there something that can give us a really good bang for our buck in terms of reliable, but also would make a difference?
Yes. So, you think about, and again, this is kind of getting into the scientific stuff, but you know, if your model isn't even set up to allow environmental terms in it, then how can you expect to look at environment in your model? And a lot of our models were never set up to include environment or species interaction or habitat, all these things that we're talking about. So, you know, we have a structural issue in our models that even if we wanted to, it's hard to do. So then that, you know, comes back to our regional action plan. You know, work on the models to be able to include habitat, species interaction, and environmental change. And there's two models which have been developed at the Northeast in the past year. One is the Age Structured Assessment Program. And they've recently included the ability to include an environmental covariate in that. Temperature is a huge driver. When it's 95 degrees outside, I'm hot, and when it's 32 degrees outside, I'm cold. Temperature really influences biology. So temperature is a sort of an easy place to start. So there's the Age Structured Assessment Program, which now allows environment, and then there's a new state-spaced model, which was developed by Tim Miller based on a model which was used in Europe, which also allows environment to be included. And that has been used in the Southern New England yellowtail flounder context, and the ASAP model with environment is being used in a winter flounder context. But then once the model is developed, it's developed for winter flounder, then it becomes a tool which is available for any number of other assessments. So that it's developing the modeling capacity and also developing the understanding of how to incorporate environment into population. Yeah, I mean, temperature, you know, when you look across, you know, from cellular function to community dynamics, temperature leaves an effect on across that whole range. So temperature is a big one, but it's not the only one. So predator-prey interactions, pH, you know, we need to sort of start working in the understanding of these other processes. But my perspective is always stepwise. We have very good temperature data. We have an understanding of how it affects biological systems. And we can start with temperature, but build the capacity to include these other components.
Yeah, I just had a follow-up on that. So, I mean, I was just curious, because a lot of us have just played around with the AMO, and as you pointed out, as you move further back, there's less and less temperature information. So even with a lot of our longstanding fisheries surveys, fisheries independent, data collection, we might have not been collecting all those very fluids. So, is there a process moving forward where, instead of actively being worked out over looking for proxies that maybe we can, something outside of just tracking the AMO, or we can use that regional approach of saying these surveys, we do have some temperature data source,
Yeah, so there's, you know, two ways to approach it. One is like a proxy. So you, you know, use tree rings as a proxy for temperature in Chesapeake Bay. So that the true proxy approach, there's you know, possibility there. The other is, you know, as the modeling capacity develops, you know, using a model that takes all your past observations, no matter what it is, and uses that to sort of bound your model, but then let the model run dynamically. And so, there, you know, there are efforts in the region to develop. They're called hindcasts or reanalyses. Reanalyses in the atmospheric community, hindcasts in the oceanographic community. So there are these, you know, efforts to develop these hindcast models that would then give you a temperature, a salinity, you know, a light observation at every grid point in the model. And then, you know, sort of the, you know, not cutting edge, but more advanced is adding, you know, simple biology to those models. So you get the carbonate chemistry cycle, you get the oxygen cycle. So you can start pulling out dissolved oxygen carbonate chemistry. It's not an observation, but it's a, you know, an observation-influenced model-derived estimate. That will help you start, you know, being able to look further back. And I think the work which is being done is about 50 years back. The past 50 years, you know, the observation across, you know, all those ocean variables is very, very light. So it's hard to do. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so there are, you know, efforts underway to make that more possible.
And Rachel.
You mentioned you're working with your economists and your social scientists. And do they have any recommendations for panels like ours when you're thinking about adaptive management and something in a species that we know is moving around or we don't quite know what, how huge fluctuations are going to be? Do we have adaptive management strategies that we can still try and keep our community strong as we're
I'm not a manager, nor am I a social scientist. So I have two strikes against me. But, you know, I will say that, you know, Mid-Atlantic Council and Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission being here today has been an excellent opportunity. I think as we start talking about, you know, the science, the biology, the physics, the climate, the management, the social, the economic side, and start working across those communities, we will get to where you want to go. I'm trying to think, like, in the right in, you know, the near future, there are several projects that are trying to work from this climate to fisheries to social. I can think of three that are in that realm. So maybe we could, you know, give you that information specifically. But that's where we really need to go because, you know, fisheries is, I mean, I love, you know, I love fish. I love the animal fish. But many of us aren't here because we love the animal. It's the economics and the social interactions that we have with fisheries that, you know, bring groups like this together. So we really need to work on the climate, the fish, the fishing, the community scale. Those, that working across that scale is really just developing.
Any other questions from the commission? Dr. Hare, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. This has been very edifying here. Thanks for coming all this way. I have a last question for you.
Yes,
want a job?
Ask me in 60 days.
Oh, yeah, that's when the acting position is going to be.
120, but I figure if you got to start 60.
All right, I'll call you.
Very good, thank you.